This is a very interesting and special time within church history. There is much that will happen here and much that we will not be discussing in detail. We are going to basically fly through the history of Christianity within the 13 colonies, and I'm sure you're going to have a favorite story, and we're probably not going to hit on your favorite story, but there still is much here that is to be learned from this. I'm going to start with a quote from Roger Williams that I got from Gonzales. This is Roger Williams, the famous Baptist who founded Providence, which is now Rhode Island. He says, "God requires not a uniformity of religion to be enacted and enforced in any civil state, which enforced uniformly sooner or later is the greatest occasion of civil war, ravishing of conscience, persecution of Christ Jesus and his servants, and of the hypocrisy and destruction of millions of souls." And that is something that Williams did believe. He was a Baptist, and though he didn't stay a Baptist for very long, as a Baptist, he did not believe that the civil authorities should be given the authority to enact church law. Now, that's contrary to what the Anglicans believed, and certainly, as we've seen in church history, that's contrary to what the Roman Catholics believe. There was much that happened during this time period prior to the colonies starting in the New World. There was much naval discovery that happened during the 16th century. Late 15th, early 16th was a great time of invention in the world, especially in the area of naval exploration. This one famous treaty here is, I'm probably not going to say it right, but the Treaty of Tordesillas. And this is Spain and Portugal's navies began to grow, and they began to, just about have a war with one another over who was going to settle where and how. And the Pope had had a lot invested in them going out and exploring because, you know, that the Pope likes to have the church and the state linked together. And so these are basically his minions that are being sent out here, and he can't have his minions fighting with one another. And so his minions need to get along. And so if you have ever been traveling in a car for a long trip with young children, and they're sitting in the same seat with one another, and they begin to fight with one another over who is where and on what side and who has whose toy on what side and who's breathing whose air and who's looking out whose window. Apparently, I'm the only one that has this trouble, but okay, I got at least one person shaking their head. And so what is it that you tell the children? No? Okay, you don't have to answer that. But you tell them, okay, this isn't always the best parenting strategy. I know. I'm not telling you to do this. I'm just telling you this is a common way we handle this. We say, stay on your side of the seat, right? And there's going to be some line in the leather or the vinyl or whatever. And that's it. Like, you stay on that side. You stay on that. And you're going to have one kid that's going to try to inch his, you know, it's usually the boy, right? He's going to try to inch his pinky across that line. And the other one's going to yell. And maybe it's just my family. But that is how that's the example I would give for what the Pope did here. He basically drew a line and said, "Okay, Portugal, you stay over here, and Spain, you stay over here." And you can see how that line—that's funny—that line there crosses right there in Brazil. And we know that people in Brazil now speak Portuguese; they don't speak Spanish. The rest of South America, Mexico and Central America all speak Spanish, but Brazil speaks Portugal because supposedly, this is how the story that I was taught in public school, after seeing this part of it, it's kind of hard to believe that it happened just the way I was told, but he was going around Africa and it just so happens that his ship got off course and he ended up in Brazil and claimed all of that for Portugal, and they obviously ended up crossing this imaginary line that the Pope had created because Brazil became a colony of Portugal, but the goal in these routes is they were trying to find a route to to India. And Portugal was given the southern route, which would go around the southern Cape of Africa. And Spain was given the western route, which, of course, they first tried to go straight west, and that didn't work out so well. And then they began to travel south under South America. And that's the degree to which we're going to emphasize that. But I want to stop at this point, and I want us to think about why we're doing this. Because I was thinking over this part and finding this fascinating and thinking, you know, I wonder if there's people sitting in front of me that are going to be thinking, why is it that we're sitting here in Sunday school and we're studying the exploration patterns of Portugal and Spain? What does this have to do with, you know, my life here? Well, it has to do with your life here because we are studying church history, and where you are now is impacted by things that happened previously to you, like people in Portugal, people in Brazil speak Portuguese because, well, the explorer from Portugal landed in Brazil and claimed it for Portugal, so then people there began to speak Portuguese. People throughout Mexico, Central America, and into South America all speak Spanish. Well, why? Well, because the Spanish colonized those areas and spread the language throughout those areas. So it's important to see how these things take place. But I believe that there's even an importance in Christianity itself to think back upon history, because we have a religion that's a historical religion. Now, this is a subtle sidetrack, but it's something we've covered before. And it's just a reminder that I want us to have is that Christianity is a religion that is a historically verifiable religion. Now, we talked about this in our first couple lessons in Church History 1, and this is something that makes Christianity distinct from other religions. You can look at other religions like Buddhism, and we're not even sure what century Buddha lived in. They're not really sure. This is an Indian statue of him. When you look at Hinduism, it's not really based upon anything that is historical. It's more of just the so-called transcendent philosophy that is just kind of, in some ways, it's pragmatic and it kind of works for people within where they are. Taoism, the same thing, not really based on historically verifiable events that support it. This is rather more of a philosophy as well. Islam as well, doesn't have... It does have history. It does have events that surround the life of Muhammad and other things during that time. But so much that he espouses within the Quran is not historically verifiable. And even more than that is contrary to things that are historically verifiable centuries and centuries before that. Much of what he writes about Christ and even understandings of New Testament doctrine is based very much upon Gnostic Gospels and writings that aren't even accepted by Christianity. I'll just say one. I don't want to get sidetracked on it, but just one for instance is there's a in the Quran there is a miracle where Jesus begins to speak when he is an infant. I didn't know about this because I hadn't read the Quran. But I had a Muslim that was talking to me, and he's telling me about the great miracles of Jesus, and I was like, yeah, I understand them. He said, you remember when he was speaking as an infant? And I was like, no, he didn't know why. How do you not know about this? I'm like, no, that's not in Scripture. It is in the Quran, and it turns out to be in, I believe it's in the Gospel of Thomas. But my purpose in emphasizing this is that we have a religion which has an emphasis upon history, and we have in the Old Testament great genealogies and great evidences of history that exist there. That's one of the reasons why we study church history, is because we can see where we are at this time. We can also see the events that impacted other people. And we can also see the doctrines and the struggles that people dealt with at other times previously, because we don't exist within a vacuum. We don't have to recreate the wheel within our time period. We can kind of see things that people dealt with previous to our time. So that said, this is one of the reasons why Protestantism ended up spreading throughout so much of the northern part, because that's where Protestants had spread. Why is it that Catholicism spread throughout some of the southern states and then throughout Mexico, Central America, through South America? It was because the Spanish had colonized within that area. And we're going to see some very unique people that are going to colonize this northern portion of the United States that are going to make, in many ways, a great impact upon the country that came about out of that, out of those colonies, and even upon this nation that we have even right now. We're not going to fully explore that as far as we possibly can. But some of those first things happened whenever missionaries came over with Columbus. Here, I want to give you some historical perspective, though, of the different things that are happening during this time period, during the early colonization. And here's a quote from Mark Knoll, and I actually stole this quote from another lecture that I listened to by Dr. Fortson at RTS. And he says, Martin Luther was nearly 10 years old when Columbus first arrived in the Western Hemisphere. John Calvin was seeing the first institute of the editions of the Christian religion through the press when Jacques Cartier claimed Canada for France. Hernando de Soto was exploring Florida and the lower Mississippi Valley when Ignatius Loyola received papal approval for the Society of Jesus. And so there's much that's going on the other side of the pond when we have other things going on this side of the pond. But the first missionaries that came over were Roman Catholic missionaries. They were primarily tied to the conquistadors that came over and they conquered. Many of them ended up enslaving the Native Americans. That's a habit that even some of the Protestants end up getting into, that they just enslave the Native Americans. They see them just as, well, almost as less than human, and they are enslaved. The Jesuits don't do that so much whenever during their times. But going on from there, I'm not going to go through the history of the Catholic missionary movement. I want to get on to the Protestant. And from there, we have the beginnings of the colony in Virginia. And in Virginia, you had Sir Walter Raleigh was given a charter by Queen Elizabeth, and it was the first British colony that was given in the New World. They tried two failed attempts at starting a colony. They tried to start a colony in a terrible location. You can look at the history of it. It's the first two just were disasters. The third one was pretty much a disaster as well. And it was a settlement founded in 1607 by the Virginia Company. And it was called Jamestown. The goal was to make profit in the New World. It wasn't primarily to seek religious freedom. In fact, I don't think that was their desire at all. It wasn't primarily. In fact, most of the people coming over weren't devout Christians. About 5% of the colony were regular churchgoers. They were of the 500 that first arrived. 460 of them died. Many of them were very focused on, you know, getting wealthy more than they were focused upon trying to, you know, we landed in a new place. We don't have any way to support ourselves. We need to get things situated. There's a learning curve that comes about there. This is an Anglican colony. That's a very important fact here, because these Anglicans will be persecuting Baptists here in the times to come. A secondary desire of this was also to plant this colony, and it was going to be a curb for Spanish encroachment into the north. So by having this Virginia colony, the Spanish were not going to continue to settle northward from there. And I think it worked in many ways. The Puritans at this time period were beginning to grow in strength in Parliament. And there's a civil war that's going to occur over part of this time that we're not going to get into in great detail. But during this time period, the Puritans were growing in strength in Parliament, and they were having more of a following. And their desire was that this first colony was going to be a Puritan colony. It was going to have strict adherence to Sabbath worship. They were going to have mandatory worship twice a day. There was going to be punishments for immodesty and profanity. King James hated that idea. King James hated the Puritans, so that's not what he had here. It's also, I want to comment that it's hard to judge. Sometimes we will read the history books, and I don't want to step on any toes. I just want to say the way I see this, and you don't have to take this as truth. But it's sometimes hard to judge the spiritual barometer of some of these colonies, because when you sit under the teaching of some, you will have this idea that it was just this utopia where everyone was a Christian and everyone was following after truth and everyone was. And I think as we walk into the New England colonies, you're going to see that no, not everyone was a Christian. And it's skewed, because in these colonies, these Puritan colonies where you force people to go to church, where you force people from the civil magistrate to follow these particular rules and these laws, you can kind of have a picture of Christianity that looks kind of Christian. And when you look at it from a history book, it looks like a very Christian situation. Well, maybe not necessarily. Maybe not necessarily. And I think you'll see that in certain areas as it flows out. But this Virginia colony became profitable, and they began to need labor for the tobacco, because the tobacco was a very profitable crop, but it was also a crop that was very labor intensive. And so it is at this time, about 1619, I think it's about 12 years after the starting of this colony, that they began to bring slaves over. Now, this is a very sad part. First off, it's sad that they're taking people from one continent, piling them into a ship, half of them dying at times, and then bringing them to another continent, forcing them to be slaves for their entire life. That's sad. But I would say there's even a sadder part here within this story in Virginia, and that is that they were not evangelizing the slaves. I would imagine the first problem is that only 5% of the people at this time period were attending church within this colony. It wasn't a very solidly Christian group. I'm not saying it wasn't ever, but in this beginning periods it was, and I think it's even evidence that their heart wasn't in the right place in some of the decisions they made economically. But they did not evangelize the slaves in Virginia. Now, that's not true with everyone, but in Virginia, they did not. And one of the reasons why they didn't evangelize the slaves was because that there was a law that said you could not put a Christian in slavery. So you couldn't enslave another Christian. They would get that from Old Testament, I guess it would be civil law, that said that you could not have another Jew as your slave. And so they did not give the gospel to these slaves. There's also probably, this aspect of the more that I'm educating this slave, the more likely the slave is going to be to no longer be my slave, to find his way out of here. So they just keep them in ignorance. I don't know. So in some ways, I see these patterns where you are most profited by someone else's ignorance, and you are most profited by someone else's lack of ability to care for themselves. It's, in one way, reminds me of what we were seeing within the Roman Catholic Church, just a few years earlier, where that was the goal. The goal was not to have the Bible in the language of the common people. They had greater strength when the kings had less power. They had greater strength when the people had less knowledge. How sad it is for people when their greatest strength is in someone else's weakness. So then we're going to go to the northern Puritan colonies. There was a Puritan colony that was started in 1620, and this is going to be the Pilgrims. They had fled to the Netherlands. I'm sure many of you are very familiar with this story. They had fled to the Netherlands and then fled to the New World, and this colony was started primarily for religious and political reasons. They were a group that had dissented from the Anglican Church, and these were Congregationalists. They did not believe in the church government that the Anglican Church had, and they were getting persecuted for it because they were not sanctioned by the state to be preaching. And so they go on and they flee. Initially, their goal is to set up an area where you can have freedom of worship. They're not going to fully follow that out. In fact, a lot of these places, they desire to have a freedom of worship, but they desire to have a freedom of worship that they agree with, a freedom of worship that they like. You will find places where there is more of a freedom of worship. We're going to see that in Pennsylvania. We're going to see that in Rhode Island. But the Puritans came over. Initially, they were they came over. 101 settlers traveled on the Mayflower, and they originally intended to land in Virginia. It did not happen. They landed in a place known as Plymouth. And this would be a place that would cause them great struggle for the short term, but in time they would end up becoming very prosperous because of the resources that existed here and because of the autonomy that they would have here and because of, I would argue, the many other Puritans that were going to come over because of the freedom that they could have by existing in these areas. And these were very industrious people that had a very strong biblical worldview, and that impacted the way that they lived, and that it profited them economically, I believe, that you can argue. Here's a picture of the pilgrims on the Mayflower, and there's them when they first landed. They had a incredible work ethic and something that Jamestown did not have in its beginnings. As soon as they landed, they realized that they had no governing structure. They knew they were not in Virginia. I don't know if they knew how far away they were, but they were at good distance from Virginia, and they realized they had no governing structure. And so before they got off of the ship, they created what's known as the Mayflower Compact, and they committed themselves to just and to equal laws. And as the Puritans come over, they're going to have to begin to work out how some of this is going to go, because the Congregationalist and the Anglican Puritans are not all going to have the same view. Only 50 of the initial 101 pilgrims survived after that first year. They were in the New England winter. They weren't prepared. They were struck by a great epidemic, and 50 of them, looks like 51 of them died. But they set up the Massachusetts Bay Company, and soon thousands of people in the years to come. And just it didn't even take a few years after that many people began to immigrate over to this area. And the Congregationalists and the Separatists did exist in reasonable for they had difficulties here and there, but at first they got along really well. One of the problems that we're going to see is that the Congregationalists were trying to take some things to their logical conclusion. The Congregationalists began to desire there to be a profession of faith for church membership. And here's a part where I want us all to really think about this and how this even still affects people today. And so the Congregationalists would still baptize infants, but they did not want to give communion. You know, they didn't want to give communion to the children, and they didn't want to give communion to just anyone, because they began to realize that many of the people that were sitting in their congregation were not converted. They had no, you know, real change within them that had ever happened. They kind of grew up within a Christian family. They continued to live within a Christian society, but they had no rebirth that had ever happened. And in looking at the New Testament, they began to say, you know, this is a really problem. This is going to end up being a big problem for Jonathan Edwards. Here's a quote from Gonzalez, where he says, "A Christian commonwealth is conceivable only if, as in ancient Israel, one becomes a member of it by birth, so that the civil and religious communities are coextensive. For that reason, it was necessary to baptize the children of the covenant." And so that's one of the reasons why they did it, was because they were creating this Christian society, and they were going to live under these Christian laws that were set up, and so you would be born into this covenant community, and then you could be excluded from this covenant community. Now, the big problem with that is that they weren't ever commanded in Scripture to set up such a community, and you'll see different people set up these communities, and they're not all the same, because they don't have they were not given instructions on how to set up such a community. There are some today that still believe that they have a plan for you on how you can set up such a community, and they have many, many, many books that you can read of theirs that will tell you exactly how you go about setting up such a community. I believe that the main thing that we need to understand through this is that we need to understand what the spheres of influence are, that we have a civil sphere of influence, that is the government. We have a church sphere of influence, that is the church, and we also have a family sphere of influence. And these spheres, there may be times where certain ones may slightly cross, but they are not the same. And I think that's one of the problems that they began to step into, is that they began to intermingle the various spheres of influence and in who should have authority over which area. Now, this began to have a problem for them, because they were having a problem being consistent with this idea of this covenant community, this Christian covenant community, and then this idea of regeneration and the new birth and how these things work themselves out. And so they would baptize the infants, but they didn't want to offer communion to people who they did not believe were converted. Well, not everyone did this. So then you would have one church over here that allows it. You have another church over here that does not allow it. This is going to cause a problem for Jonathan Edwards, because Jonathan Edwards' grandfather is going to do something which many of them went along with, and they just allowed people to take communion because they said, well, communion will be kind of a saving grace for you. So by taking communion over time within your life, you're going to end up becoming converted by taking communion. Well, Jonathan Edwards said this is completely ridiculous, and he did not hold to this, and he ended up going the other direction. He ended up closing off the table to people who were not truly converted, and this was huge. He ended up losing his church over it. If you went to public school, I'm sure you've heard of the what's known as the Salem witch trials. It seems to be, if you go to public school, there's only a few things that you learn about the Puritans. You learn that they sat on really hard benches for all day long, and while the minister was speaking, and it was really boring, and they had to wake people up, and then, you learn about the Salem witch trials. And somewhere in there, they're going to tell you how they hate women, and they're going to have a story about Anne Hutchinson. And I was surprised when I began to read the Puritans how rich so much of what they wrote was. Now, everyone that was a Puritan wasn't good, and most of the ones that aren't good, you can't read their books anymore. But there was much that happened during this time period. But we're talking about New England, so let's at least mention it. It's important to know that about the Salem witch trials, this was not the first time that this has happened. This wasn't an isolated instance. This was a time in which Europe and even the New World, had a big focus upon witchcraft and on finding witches and on, removing witches. And this particular instance was just an absurd one, because you had a few girls that had made an accusation that some people were witches, and they had seen them do some type of witchcraft, and the people were arrested. They were thrown into prison. Some of them were hanged. Others died in prisons. And then from there, they just began to accuse other people. They started accusing some of the clergy. They started accusing some of the merchantmen. They started accusing, the political people of stature within the society. And then people said, wait a minute, what's going on? This is getting out of hand. Well, they probably should have recognized that a little bit earlier when they were throwing people in prison at the accusation of young girls. Increase Mather and Cotton Mather both began to look into this. These are two people that are, by the way, often blamed for this because they wrote against witchcraft. They wrote about much more than just witchcraft. Cotton Mather was one of the most prolific writers that ever existed on the American continent. He wrote much, but if you study about him in school, that's what you're going to hear about, is that he wanted the witches to be killed. He didn't agree with the Salem witch trial. When they began to look into it, they were critical of the proceedings. They found that it was unjust the way they handled the courtroom and the trials and everything. And it's funny, it's not something that you're going to find in the public school history book. They're not going to mention that part. One other aspect I want to mention is there's the Salem witch trials. One other aspect that we need to know about New England, that missionary activity began to go forward. Not everyone was kind to the Native Americans. And there were many who just kind of looked at all Native Americans weren't the same. That's something that's really important to understand. These were different groups, and they were different people, and they had different ways they lived, and that's what we need to be understand, that they were different, and you couldn't just paint everyone with the same broad brush and say, well, this happened here, so now I can just exterminate anyone. And that is what some people did, and it caused a lot of problems, and that was wrong to treat people in that way. But not everyone did that. So I want you to understand, not everyone was evangelizing them, and also not everyone was enslaving them and trying to destroy them. But much missionary activity did go forward from the people that sent out missionaries. David Brainerd is one of the most famous ones, and we've read his book before. Next, let's go on to Rhode Island and the Baptist. This is important to us because we are Baptists. We are people who would not have been welcome in the Puritan communities. They would not have allowed us to be there. We, depending on where we were, we could have gotten in a lot of trouble depending on where we are. But the Baptist forefathers were heavily persecuted. They went under extreme persecution in Virginia. And remember, Virginia was the colony that was an Anglican colony. This is Roger Williams. There's things to like about Roger Williams, but we're going to find there's a whole lot not to really like about Roger Williams. You're probably not going to hear me quoting him often in sermons. Gonzalez says this about him. After refusing to serve as a pastor in Boston, he declared that the Puritans in the colony erred in granting civil authorities power to enforce those commandments that had to do with the individual's relationship with God. And we would agree with, a lot of this from which Williams is coming from. Williams believed that the magistrate should only enforce and legislate laws that had to do with the ordering of society. So that's where he believed that civil authority should lie. He also declared, now this was not popular, he declared that the colony that they were in was actually stolen from the Native Americans and they should have paid them for the Massachusetts Bay Colony's use of the land. Didn't go very well with those that were there. He was moved to Salem. He tried to take his church and secede from the church that was there. He ended up getting kicked out of the colony. He was apparently a man of means, though, because he moved with some friends. He founded the colony of Providence, and he purchased it outright from the Native Americans. And he found a colony that had that was founded upon religious freedom. And this is what Gonzalez says. He says, such freedom was required as part of the very obligation to our worship of God. Worship must be sincere, and in all efforts to force people to worship, is actually to weaken the worship which you are calling the person to do. Someone else that was moved over there ended up being Anne Hutchinson. She was moved there when she was expelled from Massachusetts. Also, other Baptists and Quakers soon began to move into Providence. Quakers were not accepted. Even other places that began to, okay, we'll accept some of the Baptists, because when the Civil War happened in England or Great Britain, whichever you call it, some of the Baptists sided with the Puritans, and so they began to softly accept some of the Baptists. However, Quakers were not accepted, but this was an anomaly that they were accepted here in Providence. The problem is the only claim to this colony, this didn't come by a charter from the king. The reason why they had this was because he had purchased it from the Native Americans. And so others in the colonies began to refer to Providence as the sewer of New England. Providence was given an official charter and recognized as it was just recognized as a legal colony by Charles II. This is after the Stuarts came over. There was a major civil war that we're not talking about, but there was a civil war in England during this time period where the Puritans were trying to take over, and they ended up losing. The Stuarts came back into power, and that's Charles II. Williams' church in Providence soon became Baptist, so they got baptized. He was baptized himself. Shortly after his baptism, he breaks away from the Baptist. And he's just a difficult man for me to categorize. What hat do I put on this guy? Does he wear the white hat or the black hat? Or is he the good guy or is he the bad guy? And Williams is just an intriguing person because he was just not an easy person. It just seemed like he couldn't get along unless he was fighting against someone around him, or I'm speculating to say there was some derangement, because some of his actions at the end were just really weird. But that said, he lost all reasonableness from what I can see. He broke off from the Baptist. He began to associate with the Native Americans. I don't have a problem with him associating with the Native Americans, but then he began to say that even the worship of the Native Americans could have been pleasing and acceptable to God. At the end of his life, he saw all churches in the area as something that were all fallen, and looked at the Bible as something that you only just interpret spiritually, not something that you're literally gleaning stuff out of. Gonzalez does make one point, though, in his book, and he tries to show how some people try to draw a line between the Anabaptists and the Baptists that exist, well, first off in England, but then secondly, the Baptists that spring up in the New World. And you really can't find one. There's a man that wrote a book, and I didn't put the picture of it up here, called The Trail of Blood, where he tries to prove such a lineage that exists from John the Baptist all the way to modern times. The Baptists have always been here in history, and that's garbage historically. Belief is, how did they become Baptist? They read the Bible. That's my stance. Why do you have all these Baptists popping up in these various places? Well, they're reading their Bible, and they're continuing to reform. Just briefly on Maryland, Catholicism Maryland was given as a Roman Catholic colony. It was started by Charles II, and when he came back into power, and it was given to a man named Lord Baltimore. They had passed a Maryland Toleration Act where they allowed various religions to exist there. Not all religions, but they allowed some Protestants to live there. And they passed, this is what's known as the Maryland Toleration Act of 1649. Remember, this is 1 year after the end of the 30 Years' War. So you're beginning to see how things have begun to change here. I find it just incredible and of the utmost irony that just previous to this, you had the Inquisitions going on. And now you have this Roman Catholic colony that has started, and it is a tolerant colony. And one of the problems is that Roman Catholicism wasn't allowed in many of the other colonies. Lord Baltimore wanted people to worship according to their conscience and allowed people who profess Jesus Christ freedom to worship. But it didn't extend as far as the toleration that was in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was started by a Quaker named William Penn. This is particularly important to us. I'm going to make a connection here that I believe to be true. You can think through it yourself. But I think there's a strong connection between the religious liberty that exists within our country now and the religious liberty that existed within Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania was started by a Quaker named William Penn. As I said, the Quakers did not really have their own home. Well, now they had one. They had William Penn that came over, and his colony allowed liberty of worship. And many of the colonies allowed many people to stay. Most of them did not like the Quakers. They had no real safe place to go. And I think sometimes the influence of William Penn is missed in our history books. And it's not a connection that I've seen a lot of people make, maybe because I maybe haven't read a lot of history books, but it wasn't when I studied in college and through high school. I did not ever see this connection made. But I think it's important to notice that John Madison, the writer of the Constitution, was one who came from Pennsylvania. Also, Benjamin Franklin was another person that came from Pennsylvania. And Madison is one that really liked the way the religious liberty was worked out within Pennsylvania. And he liked, in contrast to what you would see in some of the other colonies, in how people are being excommunicated from the colonies, some people are being executed for their religious beliefs. Madison liked the way Pennsylvania was handling it. And so I would argue it's the Pennsylvania stance that was actually adopted within our Constitution. Pennsylvania colony allowed Jews, it allowed Muslims, it allowed Native Americans to worship as they saw fit within that colony. I think this is something that's missed by many people that talk and speak on this subject. They'll look at Massachusetts and then try to take Massachusetts and to interpret that through the Constitution, and I don't think that's what Madison was doing. I think he was going away from these other colonies that had this sectarian stance on religion, but you're welcome to go do more study on that yourself if you find that to be something that is interesting, and if you find a piece of information like you're way wrong, then I will edit this out of the tape and it won't be there anymore. People were allowed to practice religious liberty. This is important to recognize, though, and that is that only Protestants had the right to vote within Pennsylvania. So it wasn't a full liberty that everyone had. You were allowed to exist and to be there, but to be a full, a citizen of the society, you had to be a Protestant. Quickly, let's walk through the Great Awakening. This was a time of dead orthodoxy, which we had spoken of. You saw how the various groups had responded to it. You had the spiritualists that responded in their way of basically turning away from cold dogmatism and just looking for the inner light within them. You had the pietists that turned away from this cold orthodoxy by, you know, seeking to have more methods to establish sanctification and also having methods whereby you could have these outward acts of your sanctification. But I would say that the Great Awakening was the Reformed Calvinistic response to the cold, dead orthodoxy. The Reformed Great Awakening saw not the emphasis upon doctrine as the problem. So many of them said, look, we've got this cold, dead orthodoxy. Our problem here is that we're focusing on this orthodoxy. Let's focus on our works. Let's focus on, you know, what God's saying to us inside of our hearts. And that's not the direction that they took it. There were people who had been a part of churches that had right doctrine, but this doctrine was not something that was changing their lives. They might have even looked like Christian at times, especially when you're living in societies where you basically have shackles around you that are forcing you to, you know, scrub the outside of the cup and to look a certain way. But inwardly, the ministers were able to look out in the congregation and see that the people, many of the people that were there just had no real desire for anything that was truly spiritual. It was just a cultural Christianity. And this is something that, as I mentioned earlier, Jonathan Edwards had been given towards and found this to be a great problem. This had led to, even within some of the schools, a theological liberalism, a liberalism that led to a lesser emphasis on sin. It led to a lesser emphasis upon the problem of sin. It gave argument that there was nothing wrong with nature in itself. Nature was right just the way that it was. And furthermore, it made God out to just be this all-loving, kind, benevolent person who was not so much interested in the fact that you had transgressed his law. And these are things that you can go to a church anywhere down the street and find someone who's preaching something just like that. Yale at this time had taken measures to prevent such liberalism from going into their school. Ultimately, it was not successful. You can see that even now. But two main pastors that were involved in this are Theodore Frelinghuysen. He was a pastor in New Jersey, and Gilbert Tennent. And the last one is Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards was preaching within his church in Northampton. And all three of these men just began to see at different times great revivals arising within their churches. Edwards was born a child of a minister. As a young man, he had an incredible aptitude for learning. He had learned Latin, Greek, and Hebrew before he was 11. He had learned them very well. He also had a great interest in nature. You can still go online and read some of the letters. I mean, the essays that he had written. He wrote on, he had written on things that, like stars in the sky. He had written on butterflies. He was a man that was fascinated by nature. He began his studies as a very young man, and was a man that made just an incredible impact upon this area of New England during this Great Awakening. The last person we're going to speak of is a man named George Whitfield. I'm fascinated with George Whitfield. He's just an incredible man. He was a man who was 24 years old, came over from England. He made a series of 13 trips to the United States, which means that he spent about 2 years of his life on a ship traveling across the Atlantic. That's a really long period of time to spend within those conditions. He died at age 55, and he was a man at that time who had just completely had used himself for the kingdom of God. And he was an exhausted man when he died. He went to Georgia. He took many trips to Georgia, and he had founded an orphanage there. He did a great amount of fundraising. He had probably raised more charity funds than anyone else in history up until that point. He just raised money wherever he went, and he was very good with the money that he used. The money always went to where it was supposed to go. He did much work in Georgia. I think that's interesting because Georgia was originally a prison. So that sounds like a great place to. It was a debtor's colony. That sounds like a great place to start preaching. His preaching was full of drama. He would have sermons where he would speak of like angels descending, and he would. You're not going to see me preach like this because if I tried to do this, it would be a train wreck. But I'm not going to criticize someone like Whitfield who did this. And he's in the middle of preaching. He'll say, "Oh Gabriel," there is an archangel about to ascend. May he have a declaration that a sinner has been saved before he goes back. And then he would begin to yell out, "Oh Gabriel, wait! Oh Gabriel, wait! You know, there's a sinner that awaits." And it's, you know, he didn't really mean that, but it's drama. He's full of drama, and he had a voice that was just booming. That would just go on. And I am fascinated about the great amounts of people who were able to, who would go see him. David Hume, the rationalist that we talked of, was one who would frequent would frequent George Whitfield. And he was asked at one point, "Well, why do you go to see him? You don't believe what he says." And he says, "No, but he does." And he had even an emphasis impact upon him, Benjamin Franklin, an avowed deist. He was not a Christian, but he was a man who turned down many of Whitfield's offers for conversion, but they had a very good friendship. I find this to be fascinating, the friendship that Whitfield and Franklin had. One story that Franklin gave, I think it's one of his diaries, he says that anytime he would go and he would sit before Whitfield, whenever they would take up the offering at the end for the orphanages and to support the ministry, he would give all that he had. And so the next time he would leave all of his money at home, and then he would go to hear Whitfield speak, and then partway through he would get up, he would run home, grab all his money and bring, not all of his money obviously, but he would grab his money, bring it back, and he would you know, put it into the plate. And he supported Whitfield's orphanages. Franklin sold many of his sermons. Whitfield's sermons were, you know, sold really well, and so Franklin had a print shop, and he sold his sermons. He allowed Whitfield to stay in the room above his print shop. So when Whitfield was in town, and he was able to have a place to stay and to sleep. When Whitfield was banned from churches, I didn't mention that, he was not popular with some clergy. They found that the way that he, you know, just the way that he operated was something that was just not the way that they wanted to do church. And so they didn't want to have anything to do with him. He either rented or bought a building so that Whitfield could speak indoors to the people that would come to see him. That said, I just want to say one mark, and I think this mark is important just to recognize, just to give some reality to some of this. These are men who are sinful men, and you look at an Edwards, and it's difficult. Edwards owned slaves. That's something that I find troubling. A man of such brilliance and intellect was a man who owned slaves and did not have a problem with, and I'm not just talking about indentured servants, I'm talking about slaves that were brought over and purchased. Whitfield owned slaves. He had purchased slaves to operate and run within the orphanage. Whitfield went so far as to advocate for Georgia to allow slavery because he said that if the colony did not allow slavery, that it was not going to be economically viable. And this is difficult. You see this? It's a little bit painful because you see these men and their greatness and their brilliance, and then you see this and it's like, ah, that's painful. But that's what we see within Scripture too. You can see, it's so easy for us, especially in modern times, in the time where we're trying to knock down various statues of people of the past that didn't stand on the right side of this issue. And what I want us to get out of this is to see, what are our blind spots? What are the areas in which we are completely blind here in this area? We have, you know, one party in this country that will completely support abortion to all levels. Some who have even gone on to tolerate it even after a child is born.
And that party will be the first one to decry and even desire that a statue of Whitfield should be knocked down because he had slaves. Meanwhile, holding on to this one particular view, we have another party that, in my opinion, is oftentimes just a little too much in a hurry to get on the battlefield and to begin to fight someone in another country. And so we have blood on our hands, I believe, even within our society here. And so my desire is that whenever we see some of these topics here within church history, that we do some reflection towards ourselves and we begin to look at what are our blind spots, what are the areas that we are missing. It's so much easier to look at someone like Abraham and say, I wouldn't have been like that. I wouldn't have, said that my wife was my sister. I would have trusted in the promise of God. Would you? What are the areas in which you're not trusting in the promise of God even now within your life as, you get angry when something doesn't work out like you desire? Are you not, refusing to trust in the promise of God that Christ will be all that you ultimately need? That said, Phyllis Wheatley was, this is where I'm going to end, but Phyllis Wheatley is a famous poet, and she wrote a poem about Whitfield that I'm just going to say the very end of it. I'm just quoting the end of it. You should go back and read it yourself, but she says, "Let us view him, yon azure skies, let every mind with the loved object rise. No more can he exert his labouring breath, seized by the cruel messenger of death. What can his dear America bring but a teardrop upon his happy urn? Thou tomb shalt safe retain thy sacred trust, till life divine reanimate his dust." And Whitfield was one who did, although he had slaves, he believed in evangelizing people who were enslaved, and there were many people that came to hear the good news of Jesus Christ through him. So I say praise God for that, and I think we're going to close it off there because it's time. Does anyone have any comments or questions?